You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Good morning. Good morning. Welcome to today's Technology Town Hall with Commissioner Julie Brill. My name is Eric Goldman. I'm a professor on the faculty here at Santa Clara University School of Law. I'm also the director of our High Tech Law Institute. Today's event is part of our State of the Net West series. This is an ongoing series of conversations that we've been arranging between decision makers in Washington, D.C. and the Silicon Valley technology community. We think that these conversations are crucial. It's an opportunity for us as the Silicon Valley to speak up and share our thoughts, but also to hear from the people who are at the front lines making key decisions that affect our lives and our operations. This event is co-sponsored with the Advisory Committee to the Congressional Internet Caucus, and we have Eric Kinkes here, over there, as representative of that organization, and this has been a very long-standing and successful relationship between us. We are also co-sponsoring this event today with the Margolis Center for Applied Ethics, and we have Irina Resu here representing that group as well, we'll have more to say about our work with them in just a bit. There's no question. We think about people who are making decisions that affect our lives here in the Silicon Valley. People like Commissioner Julie Brill come to mind. Commissioner Brill was appointed to the Federal Trade Commission in 2010. She's 2 years into her six-year term.
7 years.
Seven. Sorry.
Well, actually, six is probably a little more accurate.
Well,
six and a half.
I'm looking. It says you're appointed in 2010, and your term expires 2016.
April to September.
Okay. So, as you know, when we go to law school, we lose all ability to do math. My math skills are challenged this morning. Before becoming a Federal Trade Commissioner, Commissioner Brill had a very successful and long-standing career in the Consumer Protection Enforcement Agencies in both Vermont and North Carolina. I had the pleasure of meeting Commissioner Brill for the first time in December last year at a conference in Colorado. I instantly said, what can I do to have her come out here? 9 months later, we have finally put this together. So these events tend to have a long gestation period, but I'm convinced that they are worth it. If you are tweeting today's event, please use the hashtag #SOTN for State of the Net. And let me turn it over to Commissioner Brill.
Thank you. Thanks. So, I think I just unplugged. Let me just make sure I didn't unplug something. There we go. Thanks very, very much, Eric. It's great to be here. And this has been a little bit, taken a little bit of time to get me out here, but it's really been great. And thank you so much to the Internet Congressional Caucus, Eric, and his colleague, Tim, who isn't out here, but who we've been working with to help arrange this. So what I thought I would do is talk a little bit about some of the hot issues that are going on in Washington that I think you all might be interested, and then I very much want to open it up to discussion and questions and comments. So one of the things that I have been thinking about is how nice it is to be in California now. Especially now that our new season has begun in Washington. And, of course, what you may be thinking I'm thinking about, the new season being the election, is actually not what I'm thinking about, although it is very nice to be out of Washington during the election season. Actually, what I'm talking about is a season that for some of you is, I think, something you're well aware of, but for others, you may be way too young. And this is the season that every parent cherishes. It's called the back-to-school season. It's the time when we no longer have to worry about whether our 8-year-old daughter likes the daycare camp that we have her in for a week or 2 weeks. It's the time when we no longer have to worry about whether our teenage son is sitting at home on a beautiful, sunny summer day playing video games with his friends is doing the healthiest thing. So yeah, many of us are very thrilled to see our kids back in school, ready, or I guess I should say almost ready, for another year. So we might have purchased, those of the moms and dads in the room, we might have purchased lunch boxes, crayons, maybe even a new laptop to help our kids get excited about the new year. Or for some of us of a certain age, we might have written a check for an unspeakable amount for college or perhaps law school tuition, wondering whether, in the end, it might not be better for all concerned if our kids decided that college wasn't really for them and instead they strive to become the next Mark Zuckerberg, Bonnie Raitt, or Anthony Davis. But please don't tell my kids I said that. Back to school represents really a new year of possibilities. It's the opportunity that we have to reinvent ourselves. But let's face it, back to school, like youth, is definitely wasted on the young. It's time for us grown-ups to take it back. And in that spirit, it's during this season that I seek to look at things with a new and a fresh perspective, and I try to re-educate myself about the things that are important to what we're doing in Washington. And frankly, I can think of no better place for me to do that than here in California. This is my second extended trip through the Bay Area and Silicon Valley since I became a commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission. I really do cherish coming out here and speaking to those and meeting with those who are vigorously innovating, driving a great portion of our economy, and surprising and delighting consumers with each new smartphone, tablet, and cool app. Of course, the focus of my educational sojourn here is centered around what this technological revolution means for consumers. The Federal Trade Commission is thinking about several issues that are important to the tech community, but two current hot topics stand out: privacy, particularly in the mobile space, and do not track. These are the issues that I'd like to talk to you about this morning. Consumers are increasingly turning to mobile devices. Educational apps are teaching kids that I goes before E most of the time, and pi is an irrational number all of the time. But of course, kids as well as adults turn to apps for so much more: shopping, engaging with friends on social media, playing games, watching movies, even dating. 52% of college students say they often check their phones before getting out of bed, and nearly half do so while in bed at night before falling asleep. Indeed, we adults have picked up this pattern, and many adults now sleep closer to their smartphones than they do to their spouses. A majority of U.S. mobile phone subscribers now own smartphones. And the growing dependence on mobile is even more salient in some of our communities. Excuse me. About 40% of people in households earning less than $30,000 say they go online mostly through their phones, compared with just 17% of those earning $50,000 or more. And half of African-American cell phone internet users and 40% of Latino internet cell phone users do most of their online browsing on their phones. Now, as I travel around and speak to companies that are active in the mobile space, I notice that they, too, are eager to learn. They're interested in knowing more about the Federal Trade Commission and our role as the nation's premier consumer protection and privacy agency. As our enforcement actions concerning privacy practices gain more attention, app developers, app service providers, and others in this space realize that they need to think more about privacy issues. Now, of course, the tech community, and I'm sure everybody in this room, is well aware of our enforcement actions involving Google and Facebook's privacy practices, including the $22.5 million record-breaking civil penalty that Google will pay for evading Apple's privacy protections for Safari users. Industry players are also well aware that we are requiring both Google and Facebook to develop comprehensive privacy programs that an outside auditor will assess for the next 20 years. Our enforcement activity, however, is not limited to large players. We charged a marketer of children's gaming apps for its failure to comply with the requirements of the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. And we charged a peer-to-peer file-sharing app with failing to sufficiently protect the private information of consumers. When it comes to mobile, many of the players are not household names. And so our enforcement actions have involved companies that may not be on the tip of everyone's tongues. But the lessons learned from these actions are just as important as the lessons learned from our actions against Google and Facebook. Consumers, too, are becoming aware of some of the privacy issues involving mobile technologies. With more and more frequency, consumers read about apps that... Bless you. With more and more frequency, consumers read about apps that engage in unknown and unauthorized access to their address books, their photos and videos, their precise geolocation, their every keystroke, raising concerns that their private information is no longer private. These concerns are heightened when it comes to children. Earlier this year, the Federal Trade Commission took a look at kids' apps available on the two largest app stores, Apple and Android. We examined the types of apps offered and their disclosures about their data collection. I'll tell you what we found, or more precisely, what we didn't find. App developers and marketers are providing little information about their data practices prior to download. In the apps we studied, it was difficult to determine whether the app collected any data at all, and if it did, what type of data, for what purpose, and who had access to that data. These troubling findings are not limited to children's apps or to disclosures in the App Store. Just this past July, the Future of Privacy Forum found that only 48% of free apps and 32% of paid apps provide access to a privacy policy either in the app or through a link within the app. This means that a majority of both free and paid apps do not have easy access to a privacy policy. So what are consumers starting to do? They're starting to vote with their feet, or perhaps more appropriately put, their fingertips. And they're making choices based on their concerns or their understanding about the concerns with respect to the privacy practices of players in the mobile space. They wonder why a flashlight app needs to download their contact list, or why Angry Birds needs their geolocation information in order to play the game. Pew just released a study that showed 54% of app users have decided to not install a cell phone app when they discovered how much personal information they would need to share it in order to use the app. They would need to share in order to use the app. 30% of app users have uninstalled an app that was already on their cell phone because they learned it was collecting personal information that they didn't want to share. Taken together, 57% of all app users have either uninstalled an app over concerns about having to share their personal information or declined to install an app in the first place for similar reasons. Improving privacy in the mobile space will not only benefit consumers. Increasing consumer trust will also benefit app developers and marketers and others who are operating in this space. The challenge we face, however, is how to improve mobile privacy practices. One of the biggest difficulties comes from the number of players in the mobile ecosystem and how diffuse many of them are, making it tough to keep track of how consumer information is collected, used, and shared throughout the ecosystem. Mobile carriers, device makers, platform developers, and platform providers, app store operators, app developers, and ad service providers, not to mention plug-in operators, all have access or potential access to personal information about consumers. With so many players, it is perhaps too easy to think that privacy is someone else's responsibility. But that's really not the most productive way to be thinking about privacy, as some of our enforcement actions show. A better focus would be for all the companies in the ecosystem to develop a shared sense of responsibility, to ensure that they inform consumers in a realistic and meaningful way about how they collect and use information, so consumers can make knowledgeable choices about how their data will be used. Now, one way to do this is by recognizing the ability of some players in the mobile ecosystem to assist development of appropriate privacy practices by other players. California Attorney General Kamala Harris has embarked on an effort based on this idea. After the FTC's study about privacy policies, or lack of them, in the app world came out, the study that I just described, General Harris sat down with mobile app platform providers and reached an agreement that begins to address this issue. The agreement requires that platform providers, such as Amazon, Apple, Google, Hewlett-Packard, Microsoft, RIM, and most recently, Facebook, it requires them to give app developers the means to provide consumers with information about the app's privacy policies. So what do we have? We have one player providing tools to provide or to increase the transparency relating to privacy practices of another player. In a complicated ecosystem, this is the kind of effort that will help app developers and marketers put in place needed privacy practices. But much more needs to be done. Apps must post privacy policies, and they also have to rise to the challenge of communicating with users in simple terms about their practices. And app developers need to understand the privacy practices of plugins that collect and use information through their app, and software development kits that may result in the sharing of user data with third parties. At the FTC, we are working with the mobile community to help it better understand these privacy issues. We recently published a guide to help app developers adhere to best privacy practices. Early reviews of our guidance say it is a must-read for app developers and other companies in this space. So, Eric, you can put it on your required reading list. Our guidance encourages app developers to bake privacy into their app from the start. Developers should limit their information collection to the information they need for the proper functioning of the app, and they should ensure the security of the information that they do collect. If they collect sensitive information, financial, medical, precise geolocation, they should do so only with affirmative consent from consumers. App developers have to comply with the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act in connection with the collection of children's information. And app developers should be transparent about their practices. They should provide choices that are easy to use and understand, and the choices, of course, need to be honored. Honoring consumer choice is also at the heart of our efforts around Do Not Track. And I'm sure most of you in this room know what that is, but at a very high level, Do Not Track is a mechanism that would enable consumers to make choices about whether they are tracked by third parties across websites. And that includes in the mobile environment. Now, considerable progress has been made on Do Not Track. Microsoft, Mozilla, Apple, and most recently Google have indicated that they will incorporate Do Not Track choices into their browsers. The Digital Advertising Alliance has developed an icon that appears in its members' ads, providing consumers with a tool to indicate their preferences about behavioral advertising. The Digital Advertising Alliance, which is also known as the DAA, has also said that it will honor consumer preferences expressed through their browser by the end of this year. All of these developments have been very encouraging. Now, the various stakeholders have also been working together within the World Wide Web Consortium, which is also known as the W3C, and that's an internet standards organization, and they've been working to develop a standard for Do Not Track, so that there is a common understanding of what all industry players will do when they learn that a consumer prefers to not be tracked. It has been critical for the W3C process that all stakeholders are at the table: trade groups, individual companies, civil society, academics, and technologists. The participants have all shown tremendous commitment. They've devoted considerable energy, and they've been creative. Most importantly, the participants have demonstrated a sincere willingness to compromise throughout the process. This has enabled the participants to work through a number of thorny issues and to resolve them. So much progress has been made, and so much hard work has gone into this. Of course, there are some important issues that remain, but it would be a shame if all that progress was wasted by an inability to resolve these remaining issues. That wouldn't benefit anyone. It wouldn't benefit industry, and it would not benefit consumers. Now, as I know some of you are aware, a majority of the Federal Trade Commission has called for a do-not-track mechanism that would not only control receipt of targeted ads or behavioral advertising, but would also allow consumers to prevent the collection of their information. At the same time, the Commission, and the majority that is very supportive of Do Not Track, recognizes that there are some necessary and appropriate exceptions to a consumer's ability to prevent this collection. The participants in the W3C have generally agreed on the necessity for certain appropriate exemptions, like security, fraud prevention, frequency capping, and where the data cannot be linked to a specific user or a specific device. In addition, some stakeholders have called for exceptions for market research and product improvement. I encourage the W3C participants to carefully define the kinds of activities that should come within the exceptions for product improvement and market research. We need to make sure that these permitted uses are not given such broad meaning that they become exceptions that swallow the rule. On numerous occasions, the FTC and other stakeholders have asked the advertising networks for specific market research and product improvement uses that require retention of linkable consumer data. The advertising networks are the only ones who can make the case for such use. Without input from them, it will be hard to see how such uses can be justified when a consumer has opted out of marketing, and has opted out of tracking. I look forward to the W3C stakeholders drilling down into this issue. I also encourage the W3C stakeholders to address appropriate retention periods, in particular with respect to market research and product improvement. At least as an initial matter, the W3C participants should consider whether, after a short time frame, let's say 30 days, for instance, companies should be required to render that data unlinkable and commit not to relink it or to delete it altogether. W3C should address retention periods for two reasons. First, the FTC has always noted the importance of data minimization as a way to enhance data security. Retention periods that appropriately limit the amount of time a company can hold data in linkable form promotes good data security practices. Second, appropriate retention periods will provide consumers with the certainty that their data will not be maintained indefinitely until companies can figure out how to monetize it. As I said, these are important issues. While it may not be easy to find consensus, failure to reach agreement could be problematic for both industry and consumers. I am concerned that if consumers are not provided with an agreed-upon universal means to control the collection of their data, they will increasingly turn to tools, or to other tools, I should say, to prevent tracking. These self-help tools are likely to be more blunt than what is currently under discussion in W3C. They may not offer consumers the ability to make granular choices about tracking. and this would be less helpful to consumers as well as to industry. These self-help tools could also contain more restrictive defaults than currently under discussion in the W3C. So without a common standard in place, we could see an increased technological arms race with consumers using new tools to block tracking and trackers trying to circumvent those new tools. Now, we can avoid heading down this less desirable path by harnessing the good work that has gone into the W3C process so far and coming to closure on it. Excuse me. Consumers will benefit from a greater understanding of information collection and use practices and implementation of necessary protections. Businesses will benefit because they will attract and retain more customers by assuring consumers that the information that they want to remain private will be just that. It will remain private. So with that, thank you very much for your attention. Again, thank you to Eric, thank you to Tim, thank you to other Eric, to everybody for having me here. And I look forward to the discussion. Thanks very much. So what do you all think? And I'm gonna sit back down over here. We'll have a discussion. Do you follow the rule that a student has to ask the first question?
No, and I'm just trying to be polite, but I think we have to go
ahead.
Yes.
I have a question. So I've heard a couple times, you know, just in passing from folks, that the companies are, you know, storing data that they may not have and need to use immediately, because the idea is, you know, with mushrooming of data and analytics, there's a view that, hey, soon there's going to be uses for this.
Right.
Are there any instances you can think of where that sort of mentality might be okay? You were talking about it, unless there's a need for the data to service the app, companies shouldn't keep it.
I'm so sorry. And by the way, you know, if you all don't mind, you can certainly be completely anonymous as far as I'm concerned, but if you would just let me know, like, your name and where you are, like if you're a student or a professor here or you're working with a company, that would be really helpful to me. So let's remember the context of what I'm talking about, okay? These are individuals who have indicated that they do not want to be tracked, okay? So they have opted out. They have said, do not track me. Do not collect my information except for permitted purposes. So I think in that context, the notion that, well, we ought to be able to still collect all this information about these particular consumers because we might need that information at some point in the future, I think the balance there tips in a very different direction. Frankly and truthfully, with respect to outside of a do not track context or with respect to consumers who have not opted out, I do have concerns about the ubiquity of data collection and what is happening to the massive amounts of information that are being collected about each and every one of us and what's happening in terms of profiles being created and much more particularly how that information is being used. And that's a different discussion, and I'm very happy, and I do want to talk about that because I think that's really the nature of your question. But just to be clear about the context in which I was talking, you know, do not track. You've got this group of people who are saying, don't collect my information. They're making an affirmative choice. And I think in that context, the desire of the companies to, you know, of what we'll call big data, right, the analytic companies to sort of slice and dice as much data as they can, that balancing ought to change. So, but even in the context outside do not track, and even in a context of just general data collection, I do have concerns when this vast amount of information is used for purposes that either fit squarely within purposes that we as a society have said consumers ought to have heightened protections or come very close to those uses. And Congress passed a law, 40 years ago, if I did my math right, the Fair Credit Reporting Act was passed in the 70s. Where Congress said that information that is a credit report that is used for employment, credit, insurance, and also housing and some other uses, when that information that is a credit report is used for those purposes, consumers have heightened protections. They have the right to see the report. They have the right to correct the report. Now when it's used in a way that renders a less favorable decision to a consumer, the consumer has the right to know that. And I am concerned that a great deal of this, or some, I should say, of this data collection, this mass aggregation of data, is going to start to be used for purposes that either fit squarely within those, what I'll call the red zone, those uses that are focusing on what I'll call substantial benefits for consumers. Again, employment, housing, insurance, credit. Or the uses come awfully close to that line. And there have been a lot of articles about this lately. So, short question, long answer. Apologize for the long answer, but I just wanted to be clear, number one, about the context I was talking about, but also about the larger issue of data analytics. And, you know, we can talk further about that.
Oh, well, thanks. I don't need to be anonymous. Jim Snell from Bingham & Ketchum.
Great, great. Nice to see you again, Jim.
Hi. I'm Laura Reichel. I'm from the Marcus Applied Ethics here in Santa Clara. And the current do not track that's being discussed is really a plea, not an order, right? It really should be called please do not track. And my question is, does the FTC have any role vis-a-vis companies that would not respect that even if they receive them?
So that's an interesting question. And by the way, thank you for co-sponsoring my presence here. I appreciate that. It's an interesting question, and I think I semi-agree with you that it's a plea. And here's the reason I only semi-agree with you. To the extent that, for instance, the Digital Advertising Alliance adopts a do-not-track mechanism, which they have done through this icon-based system, and to the extent that they require their members to participate in their system, if you're a member of DAA, then it's required that you comply. And if you fail to comply, arguably there could be consequences not only through the DAA, but also ultimately through an enforcement an enforcement mechanism that we could operate. Similarly, an industry standard setting organization, such as the W3C, if they are able to get over the goal line and accomplish the ultimate purpose of setting up a do not track system, that would be an industry-wide standard, which presumably, you know, members of the industry would indicate that they will comply with. So in many ways, you're right. The majority of the Federal Trade Commission has come out and said, yes, please develop, we've said to industry, please develop a do-not-track mechanism. But once the mechanisms are developed, I think there are some ways in which compliance with it will become more mandatory, at least to the extent that industry associations say that their members are going to have to comply, or to the extent that it becomes a standard through a standard-setting organization. So I sort of agree with you. It's more complicated than just saying it's not mandatory. Yeah.
I'm Christy Dudley. I'm a student here at Santa Clara.
Okay.
Your comment that app developers collect all the data and then decide how they monetize it later is very much true and on target. I speak with a lot of app developers trying to found a startup, and most of them haven't even considered privacy. And I find it sometimes kind of difficult to argue that they should.
Right.
Is there any teeth, I guess, at this point in time, or what kinds of arguments could I make?
That you could make to them? Well, so certain aspects of dealing with privacy are the law. So if they fail to deal with it, they could get into trouble. So that's often a very good motivator. And that's particularly around kids' information, health information, although most apps are not going to come under HIPAA, financial information. Again, the apps that are dealing with banks and are service providers for banks probably know that they come under GLB, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. But to the extent that they're kind of dealing with very sensitive information that there already are laws with respect to, then that's probably going to be a good motivator. But I think, you know, what we, one of the purposes of our issuing this guidance, and to the extent that you're talking to app developers, I would really recommend, number one, that you go to our website and look at the guidance, and then you show it to them. What it tries to do is it tries to show, and one of the things that we, and I should say I very much believe, in addition to the commission believing as a whole, is that it doesn't have to be a mindset that the app developer has, or that anyone in the online space and industry has, where it's innovation versus privacy. And I think that's been a meme, if you will, in the industry that is actually incorrect. Privacy and innovation can go hand in hand. And in fact, we see innovation around privacy all the time. And we want to encourage that and see more of it. But to the extent that an app developer that's thinking about some cool thing that they want to do starts to focus on privacy from the beginning, that's what we mean by baking it in, or privacy by design. To the extent that it's dealt with right up front at the beginning, it's the kind of thing that they can consider as they're thinking about the cool tool that they want to provide to consumers. And to your point, and the point that I was making, the point we were talking about before, to this point about, just let's hold on to the data because we don't know what we're going to be able to do with it, but at some point we may be able to do something really cool with it. You know, I would suggest that people who are talking to the app developers, and I say this to them too, I think that's a dangerous road to go down for a couple of reasons. Data security is always a problem. And if you're holding on to information that is linkable to a consumer or a specific device and you suffer a data breach, you're going to have a big problem. And, you know, there are some very notorious cases that have been out there where companies have been caught in a data security problem. And then there are lots and lots of cases that might not get as much notoriety, involve smaller players, but still can cause a tremendous amount of harm. So I think data security is probably the first and foremost reason for it. And then the second just becomes an issue that I was describing earlier, and that's consumer trust. You know, if you're holding on to consumers' data for some purpose in the future, and this is data that's linkable to individuals, or it's linkable to their specific device, like a smartphone, ultimately what you're going to do, the more this comes out and the more people know about it, is, I think, erode consumer trust. And that's, again, what we're starting to see, I think, in some of the studies like the Pew study that I was talking about. So I think there are reasons why app developers should be thinking about privacy and should be thinking about it up front. But I think the first trick is to change the mindset about innovation versus privacy, because I think that these things really can go hand in hand as opposed to being opposed to each other. Yeah. And then, yeah.
My name is David Morris. I'm with Consultant, and I'm curious why you think this is going to be any more effective with a do not call list mechanism we already have, which is flagrantly violated.
So I actually disagree with you about the do not call list. I think the do not call list is one of the most successful programs, consumer protection programs, that we have in this country. There's two things that are going on now that I think cause you to say that it's being flagrantly violated. But I should say before I begin that, luminaries like Dave Barry, for instance, have said that the Do Not Call list is the most popular government program since the Elvis stamp. I mean, people really like the Do Not Call program, and especially people of our age who remember, just getting telemarketing calls all the time for all sorts of purposes. So I think the thing that's going on now, though, that's causing this issue to rise up again, there's two phenomena. One is the law actually exempts certain types of calls, political calls or charitable calls, and that is as a result of Supreme Court precedent as well as First Amendment jurisprudence. So there's really nothing that the law can do about a certain type of call. And in the political season, as I was referring to when I first began to talk, that becomes more salient, perhaps. The second thing that's going on, and this is more recent, is with the advent of auto dialers and the advent of computerized calling, it's become very easy folks to violate the law. And it is a violation to receive an auto-dialed call for a commercial purpose. It is a violation of the Do Not Call List, and it's a violation of some of the rules that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, has. So this is a new phenomenon that we're facing, and we started to face over the last couple of years, maybe especially I'd say the last year. We're going to have a workshop next month in Washington, along with the Federal Communications Commission, where we're going to try to address how we deal with the auto dialer situation. It has become a problem, where you receive a message of a voicemail message from someone saying, you've won a prize, or they want to they have a debt that needs to be collected, whatever it is. I mean, there's all sorts of messages that are being left on all of our voicemails. And in addition, people are seeing it through their smartphones. They're getting voicemail messages and text messages. These are all violations. Many of them are violations of the law. And we're trying to get our arms around how to effectively deal with it in the context of the incredible ability of some entities to make mass calls, mass texts, with very, very low expense. So that's a phenomenon that we're trying to deal with. But I actually think the Do Not Call program overall has been incredibly successful. I agree with Dave Barry. But I also want to say that Do Not Track is not Do Not Call. They are different. And first of all, Do Not Track would not involve a government list. It would not involve, the government collecting the phone numbers or the IP addresses of consumers that didn't want to be tracked. So that's a big difference. It would be, as we have currently envisioned it, it would be an industry commitment to create a mechanism for consumers to indicate their preferences about whether or not to be tracked by third parties across the web, and then having signals sent via headers or whatever to ad networks and others who would then have to comply with those signals. So it's a different mechanism, and it's a different...
It's a legal mechanism because the technology in the phone system is a lot more rigid than the technology in the Internet in terms of providing trackability. And we don't have trackability for Do Not Call. There's no way for me to report a Do Not Call violation.
Well, we get lots of reports.
Well, but if I can't tell where it came from, what good is a report going to be? And as a network technology guy, I know about all the problems what you're describing.
There are issues around Do Not Call, and we are trying to address them, but we do get lots and lots of complaints about Do Not Call. So there are people who have figured out ways to tell us who's calling them or what the numbers are, and we have enforcement cases that we're doing as well. But it is not perfect. We do have issues to address. I agree. Did you?
My name is Bart Smith. I'm a local intellectual property lawyer. To be blunt, isn't this really turning into the consumer versus the supplier in instances where a crisp choice is given to a user? Do any appreciable number of people say, no, go ahead, take any data you can get off my computer and do what you will with it?
I'm sorry, you're talking about Do Not Track. Okay, and I'm sorry, you're saying, so are you saying if consumers understand what's
wouldn't
happening?
Virtually 100% of the consumers elect non-collectability of their data to the maximum extent possible if they were given that choice by each supplier?
So I don't think so. And I think that, for instance, Google's ad preferences page right now demonstrates that that wouldn't be the case. So Google right now offers to consumers the ability to go in to a page and indicate, number one, whether the consumer wants to opt out entirely from behavioral advertising, but more importantly, offers consumers the ability to tailor the kinds of ads that he or she will see. So you get the choice to say, Google will indicate, here's what we think you're interested in. And consumers can say, that's right, or can say, no, I'm not interested in that, but I'm interested in this other stuff. And actually, I think the data shows that many more consumers, the vast majority of consumers that interface with that page, engage in granular choices about what kinds of advertising they would see, as opposed to opting out altogether. So what I think this issue is, what at least this part of the issue that you're raising comes down to, is for companies and entities that are going to be involved with Do Not Track to do what they do best, and that is marketing, and inform consumers of the benefits of receiving behavioral ads as opposed to just any old ad. And the benefits are that consumers may be more interested in them. They may find out about more things that they want to know about, it, as opposed to stuff that they don't want to hear about. And second, of course, there's the whole issue of, to the extent that, you know, too many people opt out, we're going to have a problem actually funding this website or providing you with continued free content, et cetera. And I think, you know, the people who need to communicate these messages are really good at communicating to consumers. And I think if they focus on this the way they focus on marketing their products and services, that consumers will understand what's going on and will probably do what we've already seen the data will show that they'll do, which is engage in more granular choices as opposed to opting out altogether. Yeah?
Eric, I think just next obvious. You were talking about granularity. Is there anything that's unique in the mobile space that you think is special about mobile devices as far as granularity or privacy or Do Not Track? Are there the characteristics of mobile devices such as consumer choice that are relevant?
Well, the big issue that mobile presents is, you know, the continuity of the information through physical space, that is the geolocation tracking. I mean, that is not something that necessarily happens online. It can with a laptop or it can with, tablets and things like that. But so I think that's probably one of the biggest issues that mobile presents is to what extent is the collection of that information, how does the user, the particular user of that phone, that smartphone, interface with the physical world through the day and through the weeks and the months. That's very, very potentially rich data, but also potentially very sensitive data. So I see that as one of the big issues. I'm not sure, maybe you're thinking of something else.
Yeah, I was also thinking trying to read a privacy policy on a screen. Oh,
well. Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry. I get where you're coming from. Absolutely.
Both, really, but yeah.
What was that?
Both.
Well, so that's what I just described is one of the big differences in terms of, you know, should consumers be able to have choices about the geolocation, the collection of geolocation information. But you're absolutely right. In terms of actually being able to make choices, having effective choices offered to consumers, the mobile device definitely presents some unique challenges, some real challenges. And we held a workshop, I think it was in May. It was called the .com workshop, which meant, or what we were doing was we were talking with lots of industry players and lots of other stakeholders about how we can provide more effective notices to consumers. How can we provide simple, short icons or other information to consumers where they can quickly understand what's happening when they're about to download a service, download an app, whatever, what's happening and where they can go for more information. A big part of that workshop did focus on mobile, and we're probably going to be coming out with a report or, you know, a summary of that workshop in the near future, probably within a couple of months. In addition, Eric, the point you're raising is, you know, that's precisely the focus of the NTIA, a part of the Commerce Department's multi-stakeholder process that's going on right now in Washington, around mobile transparency. But when they talk about mobile transparency as the focus of that workshop, what they're really talking about is how do we provide information to consumers in the mobile space in a way that they can understand it. It's precisely this issue. So absolutely, it's a big issue. It's something that we're thinking about. We want to work with industry on, you know, do we want to develop a system of icons? Do we want to, you know, what is the best way to do this? And who are all the players that can provide this information to consumers? It might not be, I mean, app developers and the apps may need help from the platform providers, from the operating systems to make sure that this information flows to consumers in a very simple way. So sorry, I didn't understand your question at first.
Answer both.
Yeah. No, it's a big challenge. We recognize the challenge. We've had this workshop. Commerce is working on it. Industry is working on it. It's something that we really do need to get our arms around because of the limited real estate.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm Paul Goodman at the Green Lining Institute and the antitrust and telecommunications issues.
What is it called? The Green Lining?
Green Lining Institute.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
On the governor's desk right now, there's a bill that would basically remove the ability of any state agency or local government, anyone other than the California legislature, to regulate broadband services for voice over IP.
This is on Governor Brown's desk.
Yeah,
okay.
Right. It's happened in probably 23, 24 states. Huh. There's similar legislation in the past. I'm wondering if the FTC is going to be able to sort of fulfill this mandate without cooperation from the states.
That's interesting. So first of all, I will confess, I haven't heard about the... How many states have this law currently?
I think it's 18 have passed, and it's pending in several.
And so what it does is it says that, for instance, public utility commissions or state regulators cannot do what in the broadband space?
Well, California one specifically says cannot pass any law or take any action that has the effect of regulating IP-enabled services or VoIP-enabled services.
So... How would that's very interesting. I would wonder, for instance, how that would play or work with, for instance, California's law that requires privacy policies. I mean, would that confine that to, what would that confine it to? What would be left?
There's a statute in place, or there's a federal law directing an agency, a state agency, to do something that remains in place. But in terms of, say, the PUC or another agency,
okay.
Or the Attorney General, for example, would not be able to take action.
Would not be able to take action unless they have a law that allows them, another law that allows them to take action.
Not that allows it specifically directs them.
Huh. That's very interesting. So obviously I haven't heard about this before. It doesn't sound like these laws could do anything to affect what the FCC currently requires with respect to the broadband space, as well as just phone VoIP issues generally, and it wouldn't affect anything that we could do, I'm assuming. I'd want to think about it. I mean, I'd want to talk about it with you and with others a little bit more to fully understand. But generally speaking, although we have very, very good relationships with the state AGs and we work well with them on lots and lots of issues, typically speaking, in the privacy arena, that has happened less. And I think there are reasons for that. I think that's starting to change, especially here with California now creating its new privacy enforcement division, which I'm sure everybody here knows about. But I think, generally speaking, we tend to work more with the states on things like mortgage fraud, financial issues. Although in the past there have been some big data security cases that we have done with the states, TJ Maxx, ChoicePoint are just two that come to mind off the top of my head. So I don't think, again, I'd need to learn more about it, but I don't think that these state laws would necessarily implicate anything that we're doing at a federal level. It sounds like what they would do or potentially could do is implicate the extent to which states may be able to get involved, state AGs and utility commissions, but I need to understand how it interplays with more specific laws that do have requirements in them. Interesting. Thank you for raising that. Is Governor Brown going to sign it?
We're not sure.
Oh, interesting. Do you support it?
Opposed.
Okay. All right. Eric.
I'm curious about your perspectives about the EU cookie directive, which is a different vector than the do not track proposals
yes.
that have been floating around, but it's somewhat addressing the same issue.
Yes.
And we have some field data now that's being developed, and I'm curious what you think has been working well and where you think it might be falling short.
The EU directive? So tell me about the data that you're seeing about it, because I may not be as familiar with the data that you're thinking about. What are you seeing in terms of actual compliance or, following that?
Yeah, directive? We're seeing a variety of different interfaces and ways that websites are presenting information to their consumers, anywhere from very passive displays to much more active displays.
And you're talking about providing the choices to consumers.
Correct, yeah, yeah. Right. Some kind of notice that there's cookies being used, and then some kind of series of choices. So anywhere from something on the bottom footer says, we use cookies, and you can click on that if you want to go and do something too. The interstitial that has a slider that says, tell me on the cookie continuum where you would like to be. Mm-hmm. So obviously we're very early stages of people playing around with this, but I'm curious what you think. Do you think that's in the right direction, or do you think that that's the wrong direction?
To require entities to disclose and to receive affirmative consent, because that's basically what the European system is, as I understand it.
Well, again, it's limited to cookies as opposed to other types of mechanisms of tracking. It also, it's not limited cookies, but it thinks about cookies as a discrete unit as opposed to other ways people can do things.
Absolutely.
The notice and choice process, as well as particularly the granularity of the choices that people might be giving. As I said, we're seeing anywhere from very, very weak solutions to highly customized solutions, but I'm inferring you haven't seen any empirical evidence yet about what people are doing with those choices yet. So
I haven't.
That information is developing. We may just not have the results yet.
Right. But I have not seen the. That's why I was asking. I've not seen the data about number one. What are the different ways in which companies are trying to provide this information to consumers, and then in addition, how consumers are interacting with it. But I can say, the EU directive on cookies basically does what I suggested, which is that if a company is going to place cookies on a consumer's computer for the purpose of collecting information, sorry, did you want to interject?
Yeah, I just want to add that
sure. The
legislation, when we talk about cookies is going to be interpreted as data of any kind, of whatever you can imagine. So we shouldn't limit it just to the word cookie.
And are you getting that from the interpretation
in
the guidance?
That was the whole purpose behind it.
Yeah, I think...
Information stored or accessed.
Excuse me?
The directive speaks to information stored or accessed, and that can be interpreted as what you can...
Right, any of those forms. So, and it'll be interesting also to see what happens to the directive when the regulation, with the proposed regulation, works its way through, because that's obviously a much broader provision. And I assume, I mean, maybe you all, some of the people in this room know, I'm assuming that the directive would still be in place even if the regulation is passed, but maybe not. Yes? Okay, would be. So I'm very interested in this issue that you're raising. I have not seen the data. We would... be concerned about a regulation that really just focuses on one technology. But what I'm hearing you all say is that no, it's being interpreted much, much more broadly. I have been interacting with my European counterparts more on the proposed regulation than I have on the cookie directive. The Federal Trade Commission is now a member of and on the executive committee of the International Conference of Data Protection and Privacy Commissioners, and I'm the commissioner who interfaces with that group. And so I've had a lot of discussions with my European counterparts about the proposed regulation and some of the ways in which it harmonizes with some of the things that we're doing here in the United States and some of the ways in which it doesn't, and trying to get them to think about what may be some unintended consequences if they were to go forward with certain of the provisions. But that regulation, that proposed regulation, still has a ways to go. I mean, it's got a couple of years, I think, to work through the European process. So to be honest with you, I'm really interested in this data, especially in what happens when granular choices are offered to consumers. But here in the United States, we have not taken an affirmative opt-in approach to data collection. We have really taken... we try not to use the terminology opt-in or opt-out anymore, because I actually think in many ways it's sort of a misnomer, because you could have a very robust opt-out and a really passive and unclear opt-in. So, what we try to talk about is, affirmative consent versus, not affirmative consent. But in this country, we really have not taken that approach, which is that consumers must give permission before any of this collection can happen. And that's why the Do Not Track sort of talks about, you know, giving the consumer the option to not have themselves be tracked or have their data collected. Does that, so it's really interesting. I'm really glad you raised it. I would love to see the stuff that you're looking at.
I mean, it raises a bunch of questions about what consumers want and
yes.
how that experience goes.
Yes.
My own personal starting point is consumers don't understand the basic issue that they're being asked to opine upon. And so it seems like it's a solution to a problem that the consumers don't want to solve.
The
and,
European solution.
Yes.
So without commenting on that, per se. I agree that most consumers, you know, look, they're not using their smartphone, they're not using their laptop in order to figure out whether their data should be collected or used in a particular way. They're trying to do something else. They're trying to shop, they're trying to work, they're trying to do something. And so most consumers, you know, are not really thinking about this issue on a day-to-day basis. When they hear about it, when they understand what the implications can be, I think they do get concerned and they worry about it, but that's not what they have the ability to spend all their time thinking and worrying about. However, I do think that there is a group of highly educated consumers, probably a higher percentage in this neck of the woods than there are in other parts of the country, that do really understand what's going on and that do interact with, whether it's a European opt-in or whether it's a do not track opt-out. And actually, interestingly enough, I think that it's that very cadre of consumers who are going to tend to be more young than old, who are going to tend to be more technologically savvy than not. It's that very group of consumers that marketers really want to get their information about. So there's a certain irony here, I think, that you're going to probably have higher opt-out percentages, to use that old terminology, under Do Not Track, of the very consumers that marketers really want to track. Yeah?
My name is Paola. I'm from Peru, and I'm a student. My question is regarding the subject that you were talking before, about privacy mm-hmm. in smartphones.
Mm-hmm.
It's a concern for me, like for a lot of consumers. And for example, no, you are talking about that there are mechanisms and there are a lot of maybe policies of enforcement
mm-hmm.
that you are working out
mm-hmm.
With a lot of institutions and companies.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably think that if you talk, for instance, Android, no? They have always, when you initiate or you buy the phone, normally you have a Google account that you have to sign in. So I wonder if maybe the commission can have kind of, or maybe you have an agreement with Google, for instance, to when you buy a phone and you activate it, maybe come out a kind of app or maybe an ad for the commission. Prohibiting or telling them, avoiding the consumers
mm-hmm.
that are going to activate a phone, that is a probability that you will have a lot of problems if you get an app.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you have some maybe an agreement or a kind of what is called a work together with Google or maybe Apple for iPhones
mm-hmm.
regarding this. Like when you activate a phone, you can have some kind of
app. Right. So that's a really interesting point. So what you're asking about is whether, you know, that teaching moment, and we talk a lot in consumer ed terms about teaching moments. So a consumer is about to activate their phone. You also see this in when you're, starting a new computer, you'll go through wizards, right, where you have to make a bunch of choices about what you want to do. These are teaching moments where what you're suggesting is maybe we could have some sort of warning or educational outreach to consumers at that time. There's lots of things that can happen at that moment, and that I agree with you. That is a critical moment. And there are other critical moments. When a consumer is about to download an app is another critical moment. And I think that that we are thinking a lot, and I think industry's thinking a lot about what information can be provided to consumers at those critical moments. Frankly, to be totally honest with you, I'm not sure that's the best time to redirect consumers, like to our website with a warning about, you know, a bunch of stuff. We have lots and lots of great information for consumers, but I feel like at that moment when a consumer's activating their phone or about to download an app or whatever, loading up a new browser on their smartphone, whatever it is, that is a really good time to provide consumers with choices. The trick is, and what we're talking about, or, you know, what Eric was asking about before, is how do you provide that information to consumers in simple terms so that they can make choices easily, or if they're not understanding things, they have a way to get more information. I do agree, though, that is a really critical moment that we need to be focused in on. Yeah.
So Cheryl Miller with Verizon, and we're actually working on an app. I think I can say that. We've got the patent for it, and so we're involved on a lot of these issues.
Sure.
As a company, we do try to take this very seriously.
Yep.
I sometimes feel like I'm Darth Vader when I come to these conferences when we're talking about all these different things.
He ended up, it's a good guy at the end.
Yeah, he is.
But it took what, 6 movies to get there?
Right. But all joking aside, it's something that engineers have been very focused on for that specific reason. We just think as a company, in the perspective of the phones that we have, that would be the best point of contact. And of course, you know, you all doing your job, the great job that you do from.
Well, I try not to mention companies unless I need to. I'm very well aware that Verizon and other players in this space are thinking very hard about this issue. I didn't know that it was a particular app, but I thought, you know, I know that there's a lot of thinking going into how to better communicate these things to consumers.
I don't know where it is in the development process.
Yeah. And I applaud that. I really think that that's great. And again, it's these critical moments in a consumer's interaction, you know, because consumers are not thinking about this on a day-to-day basis, but when they're about to hit, you know, they're about to put in their credit card number, they're about to do, you know, these are the moments when you can really inform consumers about whether, you know. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Lydia, and I'm a student here. I'm interested in a topic that has to do with privacy, but it's a little bit outside of what we've been talking about. And I was wondering if you could give me some guidance as to how you will go about the topic that I'm going to explain, if you have to research it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in particular privacy, but in the security
mm-hmm.
arena,
mm-hmm.
I follow the CISPA
right.
development. It looks like it's not going to go anywhere, but I'm sure that something else is going to come up because there's really a conflict of interest here. And I will appreciate any guidance that you could give me as to how to educate myself about it, which points to look at on both sides.
Yeah, it's a really interesting issue. So we didn't get involved in the CISPA debate, and we haven't been involved in SOPA. And there's a number of very important policy discussions going on in Washington where the Federal Trade Commission, we just didn't feel that we didn't feel that it was in the center of our wheelhouse, as we say. We do a lot of work around data security, and we have a whole body of what I'll call jurisprudence around data security cases. So to the extent that you're actually interested in how a law enforcement agency brings cases against a commercial entity. You know, we're not talking about governmental entities, but a commercial entity that has suffered a data breach or otherwise does not have secure data practices. You could go to our website and you could find a whole host of data security cases. And they fall both under our deception prong of our jurisdiction, where we say a company had promised to keep data secure but failed to do so. And we also have a whole host of cases that fall under our unfairness prong, where we say that the practices were unfair to consumers. Whatever the company said about their practices, they were actually unfair to consumers because they resulted in harm that were not, and then there's other parts of that test. So that would be one thing that you might want to take a look at. I think, truthfully, you know, part of the debate is that there are a lot of folks who are involved in, for instance, criminal law enforcement and others who would like much more data retention. They feel that data retention will help them with their investigations. And, you know, truthfully, what we call for is data minimization. And the concern is that if you have too much data floating out there, it's going to become insecure and going to become problematic. But, for instance, like in the Do Not Track situation that we were just talking about a few moments ago, again, that collection of information would be by the concerns and the permitted uses and exceptions and whatnot are when come into play when a consumer has opted out, has said, do not track me, you third parties that I'm not actually even interfacing with. Okay? It doesn't affect first parties that the consumer is interfacing with. So the Facebooks of the world, the Googles of the world, to the extent that people are in Gmail and YouTube and whatnot, that's not a do not track issue, because that's first party collection of information. So I think if one were to sort of drill, you know, it's easy to sort of say, oh my God, they're all the, you know, law enforcement saying one thing, the FTC saying another thing about data retention and how do we figure this out. I think if you drill down a little bit into it in the way that I'm describing, it's not that much in conflict, because what we're talking about is the collection across websites by ad networks and other players, not first-party collection of information. Does that make sense to you?
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Let's make this the last question, please.
Sure, of course. Yeah, it looks like we do have another question.
Director Kelly, law student. You may have already answered it in your previous question there, but it seems like the Do Not Track avoids this issue of data ownership, consumer data ownership, that if I do get my permission to a third-party website and opt in, if you will, they have a property ownership of that information. Has the FTC ever considered maybe integrating with the Do Not Track to make it, I guess, easy for consumers to choose their level of privacy or data ownership, to say that these third-party companies may or may not use my information after I've given it to them, and once I do give it to them, it's a way to kind of take it back, if you will?
You know, the question of ownership of information, excuse me, I'm having trouble seeing him, sorry. The question of ownership of information, I don't think has been a fruitful road to go down for consumers. I God bless you to explore it and try to see if you can get somewhere with it. But, you know, in the credit reporting context, which again has been a robust law, there's a robust body of litigation under that law, the concepts of consumers owning information that's in their credit report, to my understanding, really hasn't gone very far, because it's actually, I mean, if one were to think about the ownership interests, there's really joint ownership, right? It is the consumer's information, but the information is information that the consumer is giving in some ways to others. We don't think about it in terms of ownership rights. We think about it more in terms of choices, robust choices being given to consumers. Now, one could argue that, well, the only reason you want to give those choices to consumers is because they have to have some ownership of it. I think it may be better to simply, from my perspective, but again, if you want to explore this in a paper or whatever, I think it's a really interesting issue. But I think a better way to think about it is that consumers clearly have an interest in it. I don't know that I, sitting as a commissioner, would call it an ownership interest. Okay. Anyway, so I think that's it, but thank you.
So I trust it's apparent now why I was so eager to have Commissioner Bill come and join us. Her eloquence, her candor, and her willingness to engage in the discussion is remarkable. And so please join me in giving a special thanks to her for her coming. For those of you who are gluttons for punishment or eager for more, we are going to continue the conversation with Commissioner Brill at lunch for a more student-oriented event where we'll talk a little bit about consumer protection, more about privacy, and about careers in consumer protection law.
That event will be co-sponsored again with the Margolis Center for Applied Ethics. It will be in Bannon 127. So for those of you who'd like to come and join us there, you're welcome to do so. Our next event on the State of the Net West heading will be with Representative Anna Issue. It will be in Palo Alto on October 9th. So please RSVP and join us for that. Before the event is truly officially over, we must finish the food. So for those of you who are still hungry, please do not be shy. We have more left. Thank you very much for coming.